Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, tens of millions of Americans watch Hallmark holiday movies every year. We will meet one of the writers behind them, Rick Garman, who grew up in Marion. But first, Marjorie Noon was a successful watercolor artist who led a colorful life and created vibrant and beautiful watercolors. She was born in Cedar Falls, Iowa in 1898 and was part of Grant Wood's legendary Stone City art colony. Her work and her life have been largely forgotten, but a new publication, Passion for Beauty, published by the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls, gives us a glimpse into her life as seen through the eyes of her brother, Ferner Noon, a glimpse that raises as many questions as it answers. Marjorie passed away in 1988, and her brother died a couple of years later. And with me to talk about Marjorie Noon is Heather Skeens, Cedar Falls Cultural Program Supervisor at the Hearst Center for the Arts. Hello, Heather.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Barbara Lounsbury is also here, Professor Emerita of English at the University of Northern Iowa and author of a number of books about Virginia Woolf. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Heather, I want to start with you because I know that this biography of sorts that Ferner Noon wrote about his sister kind of landed on your desk at the Hearst Center. Before you read this, what did you know about Marjorie Noon?
Oh, very little, to be honest. I'm not a Cedar Falls native. I'm from the Des Moines area and moved up here in 2017. So I started working with the Hearst Center here in Cedar Falls around that time. And we were mounting a show in early 2018 featuring women artists from the permanent collection of the Hearst Center. And, of course, the Hearst Center has a great collection of work by Marjorie Noon. And our curator had some work laid out. She was working on the show, and I saw a variety of work from the collection and perhaps passed over some of Marjorie's work when I was reviewing what she was putting together for the exhibition. And I think Emily, our curator, noticed that and literally went downstairs to her office, printed out this memoir, brought it up to my office, and left it on my desk and said, "You should read this." So that's kind of how my introduction to the work of Marjorie Noon began.
And, all right, so this memoir or biography, whatever you want to call it, is kind of unusual. I mean, it's a very short account of Marjorie Noon's life as written by her brother. Tell me what your reaction was when you started to read it.
Oh, well, she had a very unconventional life, perhaps from someone from this community that was active in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and seemed to have a very interesting personality. And I think there are a lot of community members here who knew who Marjorie was because she dressed differently than other people in the community. She acted differently than other people in the community. And so she had a little bit of a reputation. And he wrote about that in the biography. But what I think I was most drawn to was just this story of a woman artist that really went out independently, traveled all across the U.S. She was in Santa Fe during the 40s when Santa Fe was just the hub of arts and culture here, and produced a huge body of work. And it's really unique to have a firsthand, a primary source, you know, a memoir of an artist's life from that time from our community. So it was a really unique opportunity to learn more about her.
And when did Ferner actually write this account?
So he wrote the memoir in the mid-80s, 1985, and it came to the Hearst Center in the around 1989 when the Hearst Center opened to the public.
And when he wrote it, he wanted it to not see the light of day for at least 10 years, right?
No, actually, I don't think that was his intent. I think that was something that maybe the Hearst Center might have held on to it for a little while in the early days because it's a very personal reflection by Ferner on the life of his sister. It has a lot of personal details about her life, and I think because the Noons were such a prominent family in the community, and of course, you know, Marjorie and Ferner just passed away right in the late 80s, and so it was very fresh, and I think maybe there was a decision made, although it hasn't been recorded, but a decision made to hold on to it for a little while, maybe not publish it right away.
And Barbara, I want to bring you into the conversation. I grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and this account is sort of a who's who of names that I grew up seeing and hearing in the community. Can you tell me, first of all, when you first encountered the work of Marjorie Noon?
Well, it was through the Ruth Succo organization, and Ferner Noon married Ruth Succo, who we call Iowa's Willa Cather. She's a prominent Iowa writer, wrote 9 novels, 43 short stories, all set in Iowa. But as one who grew up in Iowa, I learned late of Marjorie. I feel bad about that. She was flamboyant. She rode around the town on a bicycle with a floppy hat, and she bathed nude in her backyard, with shocking her neighbors. So she was a flamboyant artist, and I think what is remarkable, when I was first allowed to read Ferner's memoir of his sister, I don't want to spoil it, but there's something shocking in it that happened to this young woman.
Well, we are going to talk about that. I don't think that that spoils the conversation, but it also, including some really personal and difficult details in this account, which is largely, I don't know, it's almost dispassionate in the way that he writes about, you know, here my sister did this, she did that, this was our family, this happened. But then he shares a couple of really incredible details. I mean, Barbara, what was your reaction when you first read this account?
Well, I felt so sorry, still do, for Marjorie, but thought he was writing about what happened in the 1920s to young women, and my heart still breaks for what happened to Marjorie and how it might have affected her. Well, it surely affected her art and her work and her life, and I guess we get, Ferner himself was brilliant, and he published in the New Republic and the Atlantic, and worked for Iowa Vice President Henry Wallace during the Depression, and he was brilliant himself. But he writes of his older sister, and he helped her by founding the Cedar Falls Art Association and First Art Gallery to support her work. But he writes about her, I think, as someone who, you know, was in his 80s, just knew of his family and life in the 20s in Cedar Falls.
She was the oldest child in her family. I mentioned she was born in 1898, and she was already 5 years old when her brother was born. So she was the older sibling in this family. And one of the interesting things that we learn right away in Ferner's account is that she and her mother did not particularly get along. Barbara, tell me a little bit about what we know about that.
Well, she was a strong-willed person. She was an artist, and her mother, I mean, they were a very prominent family. They owned a lot of real estate, and the mother, they were very religious. Her father not only was a prominent banker, but he was, for 35 years, he was superintendent of the First Evangelical Church in Cedar Falls, so they were, you know, a very religious family, and then they have this willful, flamboyant, colorful, artistic daughter, Ferner believes they tried to support her all the way. Fortunately, she was able to, the money they left her when they died, was she was able to live as an artist independently, so that was wonderful. But they crossed swords, to say the least.
Well, as we talk about some of the difficult things that she survived, I found myself thinking, as you said earlier, Barbara, you know, these were things that happened to young women in the 1920s. But I also was thinking about the fact that she was a young woman of privilege, and that allowed her to have the life that she had as an artist. There, reading about her early life, she was early on, it sounds like, and of course, reading through the lines and using language that, you know, we use today, it sounds like she suffered from mental illness and probably from very serious depression. And her family had her committed to the sanitarium in Independence. And she was there for 2 years. It's kind of amazing to think that she even was able to come back from that. A lot of people didn't, Barbara.
That's right. And one wonders today what she did suffer from. You know, was it, bipolar? If lithium had been around, could she have been helped by that? And we just don't know what her condition was. The fact that when she returned from Independence, she was able to go to college, got a degree, taught, was able to live and work as an artist for the rest of her life. She went to the Art Institute of Chicago and graduated before she went to Stone City. So again, many people who read this memoir say, oh, we wish we had Marjorie's diary, and it may be that we will. We've just learned that it may be available, but we'd like to hear her voice as well as Bernard's and know what she was thinking at that time. And so I don't know how serious her mental condition was.
Well, and as I said, this glimpse into her life raises as many questions as it answers. We are going to take a short break, and we will continue this conversation about this remarkable woman, Marjorie Noon, in just a moment. The book that we're talking about is Passion for Beauty, Marjorie Noon, Watercolorist, and it contains a biography of artist Marjorie Noon, written by her younger brother, Ferner Noon. Both of the Noons have passed away, so we can't get their firsthand accounts of what happened. But the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls has just published this book and has a large collection of Marjorie Noon's artwork. And with me today, Barbara Lounsbury, Professor Emerita of English at the University of Northern Iowa. A couple of her essays are included in this book. And also with us, Heather Skeen, Cedar Falls Cultural Program Supervisor at the Hearst Center for the Arts. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, we will meet a writer who has written more than 20 Hallmark holiday films. Millions of people watch those every year. Rick Garman grew up in Marion, and we will chat in a little while. Right now, we are talking about the work of Marjorie Noon. She was a successful watercolor artist, and she led a colorful life, living most of her life in Cedar Falls, Iowa, where she was born in 1898. She was part of Grant Wood's legendary Stone City art colony, and she overcame many challenges in her life. Her story is told in a new book. It's called Passion for Beauty, Marjorie Noon, Watercolorist. And the story in the book is told in the voice of her brother, who wrote a biography about her before he died. His name was Ferner Noon, and it also contains essays by Barbara Lounsbery and Robin Groth. And with us, Barbara Lounsbery, Professor Emerita of English at the University of Northern Iowa, and Heather Skeens, Cedar Falls Cultural Program Supervisor at the Hearst Center for the Arts. And Barbara, you teased us just a little bit before the break. One of the things that of course, raises so many questions in this account of Marjorie Noon's life is that we don't get to hear her voice. Her brother quotes from her diaries a couple of times, just a line here or there, which leads us to believe that there were probably extensive diaries. And in the essays, you and Robin talk about those diaries being lost, but you think that they may still be available somewhere?
We sent the book to Marjorie and Ferner's niece. Well, actually, it's the wife of her nephew, I guess I should say. And she called from, I believe it's New Jersey, and told us that not only did she have some Marjorie Noon paintings, and I think Heather can tell you she's given one to the Hearst Center just this fall, mm-hmm. but she mentioned she had the diary, and she said she hasn't read it. And so she's going through her husband's papers, and we are hoping that if she does indeed have the diary, she's very respectful of it, that she will share it with us so we can hear Marjorie's voice, as well as her brother. And I should say, without Ferner, there would have been no Cedar Falls Art Gallery that first gave Marjorie an exhibition space. There would have been no later shows. So he was the most supportive of brothers. And yet, as you say, his kind of objective telling of her very shocking early years just makes us long to hear Marjorie's view.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about, so she obviously struggled with her mental health. She was sent to Independence for a couple of years. She came home and she developed a relationship with someone who apparently her family didn't know. She became pregnant and then she was given an abortion. And the way that Ferner writes about what happened, it's really hard to know if she had any agency in that at all. But she, the fetus that she was carrying was aborted, and there was a tubal ligation performed. So, and it sounds like that was done without her understanding or without her approval. So she was unable to have children. And it was so shocking to read that detail, again, in this account that's fairly dispassionate and kind of prosaic in writing about her life. Barbara, what was your reaction when you read that?
I just felt that this could happen today, and to read and maybe was more likely to happen back then. But later in the memoir, you read that when Marjorie began to grow blind in her 80s, she had cataracts, and they urged her to have cataract surgery, and she said, I don't want to be cut, you know?
Yeah.
So you wonder that whole, how it shaped her whole life. And again, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. Heather, tell me about your response when you sat down and read this, because again, reading this account, I'm sure you thought you were going to learn a little bit about how she became a painter, and yet there are these details.
Yeah, it is kind of a heartbreaking early story, but I think, you know, going back to kind of Ferner's own words about why he wrote the memoir to begin with, he says that Marjorie's life was extraordinary, and it deserved to be told with appreciation, compassion, and a searching interest. And I think that throughout the entire piece by Ferner, he has a searching interest in trying to understand Marjorie's personal life and how it affected her artwork, and kind of bring it all full circle for us. I just want to mention, going back to the diaries, from an art historical perspective, those could be very interesting because Marjorie started keeping those diaries when she was at Stone City with Grant Wood and Ed Rowan and Adrian Dornbush. And so I think there will be scholars who might be interested in seeing some of that behind-the-scenes personal notation about what life was like at Stone City and the conversations and some of the things that were happening and what people were thinking about and whatnot. So we're very excited that perhaps Marjorie might be a door to a larger piece of research and interest in that part of American art history, too.
Yeah, very, very exciting. And let's talk about, so all of this is leading up to her discovering art. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, if she had been a young woman of less privilege, if her family had been less supportive of her, it feels like her discovery of art never would have happened. But in her 20s, she decided to go to college. She went to what is now UNI, and she trained to be a kindergarten teacher, even though I think Ferner makes it pretty clear that she had no interest whatsoever in being a kindergarten teacher. Barbara, what are your thoughts about that?
That's true, but again, we have to remember, what were the career options for women in the 1920s? You know, secretary, teacher, that's about it. Nurse, that was about it. So I don't think it's surprising. And with the Iowa State Teachers College, as it was called, right in her town, that would be an opportunity. But she, as you say, she didn't stay there long and soon got into art. And I think going to the Art Institute of Chicago just was a world opening of expression, opening for her, and gave her really the outlet she needed. And we probably haven't said enough that the fact that she traveled in the Southwest and in Mexico and Guatemala and created all these marvelous, colorful paintings showed that she found something that worked for her. So it's really, in a way, as Heather said, a story of triumph as well.
Yeah, I mean, that experience really helped her unlock this genius that probably would have remained hidden for her entire life if it weren't for just encountering some art classes when she was studying to become a teacher. And so she went to the Art Institute in Chicago, and then she studied and lived at the Stone City Art Colony. And Heather, can you tell me, just describe for me a little bit her work? This beautiful book contains many of her paintings in it, and they are so vibrant. I don't know that I've ever seen watercolor art with just the colors that she uses. Tell me a little bit about what defines her work.
Sure, she's definitely a colorist. She does have a unique palette, especially later in her work. So if you look at her early work in the 30s, late 30s, she's kind of coming out of Stone City, so it's a little bit more representational, a little tighter brushstroke, a lot of kind of landscapes and kind of Iowa scenes, let's say, or Midwestern scenes. And then as she moves forward, she goes down to the South. She's in Santa Fe and Taos and Oracle, Arizona, and she starts doing landscape watercolors, which are a little bit more abstracted, and her brushwork is really fluid. She's doing a lot of wet-on-wet painting, and they're just really expressive. And then as you get later into the 60s, you know, she's painting the color pools at Yellowstone, and the colors are just amazing, and they're much more abstracted. So you can kind of see her grow into that later style that's really, really vibrant.
And Barbara, you have mentioned this a couple of times already, and this is such an extraordinary act on the part of her brother, Ferner. In 1940, he basically donated a house that he owned in Cedar Falls to become an art gallery, to really create a community organization to show art, but also specifically to show his sister's art. And this was a really powerful act. Tell me more about what he did.
Well, it was 1940, and we weren't in World War II yet, but war was raging in Europe. And it's hard to realize, but art associations were kind of a new idea then. of the Cedar Falls Art Association, which he founded in 1940, was only the fifth art association in Iowa. The first was in Davenport in 1878, and then Dubuque in 1910, Cedar Rapids in 1911, and Fort Dodge in 1932. And it was part of the regional art movement, but Americans began to realize that local art talent surrounded them and that art wasn't just for the eastern cities. And they began to see an art center as indispensable to any right-minded town. You know, an art center was as necessary as the public library. So when Ferner founded, with James Hirst and others, the Cedar Falls Art Association, he gave over, they owned a building on Main Street, right downtown. He gave over the upper floor, which was a long 40-foot room for the art gallery. And for the next 25 years, it was a wonderful gathering. And people, Ferner knew remarkable people from his own travels. One of the first visitors was Robert Frost to the art gallery in the early 1940s.
The Robert Frost. That's incredible.
He became a friend and booster of James Hirst, the Cedar Falls poet. Also coming was Sigrid Undset, who won the 1928 Nobel Prize for Literature. She was from Norway. She came to, went upstairs to 219 and a half Main Street and looked at the art gallery, and it was a wonderful place. And they wanted to both cause what Ferner called appreciation, practice, and patronage of the arts, and he did all three. And he said farmers would come in the 40s on Saturdays and mingle with the school children and walk around the gallery. They had dinners of, you know, 50 members. For a dollar, your family could join the art association. And if you paid an extra dollar, you could go to the Wednesday night art classes that were taught by Iowa State Teachers College art professors. It was just a very, they called it congenial. It was just a wonderfully active art gallery and art scene. And it was the Cedar Falls Art Association that started the Northeast Iowa Art Exhibit that I think goes on to today. And even in Cedar Falls, Ferner was marvelous. His real gift was for creating lasting institutions. And so his art association is now, you know, the Friends of the Hirst Center for the Arts. It's now 81 years in. And there's still a Thursday night painting group that started in the 40s with Ferner and is still painting in Cedar Falls today.
Wow. Well, and we've mentioned already that after she discovered art and really started painting, and her brother gave her the opportunity to sell her art by creating the Cedar Falls Art Association, and he was obviously her greatest booster. She traveled all over North America by herself, which is really remarkable considering all of the challenges that she had early in her life. I mean, it sounds like her family probably thought that she would never be able to live independently, and yet she became incredibly independent, didn't she, Barbara?
She did, and she would load up her car, drive. Sometimes she'd take her cat Daisy Bell and go to Santa Fe and Taos and Mexico City and Guatemala, live there for a while, paint. She has some Native American images and really caught particularly that part of the world. And she loved that part of the world. But then she would come back to her very colorful house in Cedar Falls and paint. And then there would be exhibitions, one-woman shows at the art gallery during the 40s, you know, four different ones of her works. And because of the climate that Ferner set up in the association, encouraging everyone to buy the art on the walls, it really helped support her and encouraged her as an artist. And I should say that if people want to get a look at Marjorie King, besides this wonderful book that Heather has edited, the Hearst Center has created note cards for $7.95. And particularly, I would just die for Marjorie's painting of her cat Daisy Bell. And that's one of the note cards that people can have, so they can contact the Hearst Center for the Arts for those wonderful note cards.
Wonderful. Mm. Well, and we only have about a minute left. Heather, when people visit the Hearst Center for the Arts, can they see the artwork of Marjorie Noon on the walls?
We have two galleries of rotating exhibitions, but her work comes out from time to time in permanent collection exhibitions. But if somebody had a particular interest, we could definitely do that by appointment. And I'll mention, if you go to thehearst.org, I believe on our front page now there's a link you can click, which gives a list of all of the extant works of Marjorie's that we know of, which is thanks to a list that was compiled by Ferner, of course, as part of his work. But there are hyperlinks now there, so you can click the title of a work of art, and if it happens to be one from our collection, we now have full-scale, beautiful, high-resolution images. So you can pop on online and also take a look at her work that way.
Well, Heather and Barbara, thank you both for sharing this remarkable story with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The book is Passion for Beauty, Marjorie Noon, Watercolorist, written by Ferner Noon, her brother, with essays by Barbara Lounsbury and Robin Groth, and edited by Heather Skeens, Heather Skeens of the Hearst Center for the Arts, and Barbara Lounsbury, Professor Emerita of English at the University of Northern Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, I will talk with a writer who has written more than 20 Hallmark Hall of Fame holiday movies. That's coming up in just a minute. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. You might think of them as a guilty pleasure, candy for the brain, or balm for the soul. Or you might be one of those people who thinks that they're too silly for your time. Either way, every year, tens of millions of Americans watch Hallmark holiday movies. The plots might be a little bit predictable. We do need a happy ending, right? But it's hard to deny that they are good, clean fun, and they leave most viewers smiling. Rick Garman has written more than 20 movies for the Hallmark Channel and more for other networks. He's also published 4 novels, written multiple plays and travel guides. These days, he lives in Savannah, Georgia, but he grew up in Marion, Iowa, and he's coming back to his hometown this week to share his work and help raise money for Marion's Community Holiday Lights. He'll be moderating screenings of 2 of his films on December 5th and 6th, and he'll be holding a writer's workshop for teens and adults on the 5th. Here is a little bit of the trailer for his very first Hallmark holiday film, which took place in Iowa. It's called Christmas in Homestead.
This is when we're supposed to be with the people we love. That's what Christmas is really about.
Cut!
It's gonna be a great film.
A big Hollywood star that comes to town.
The most famous, prettiest actress in the world.
And winds up with 2 leading men.
You know, if this were a movie, this would be the part where we kiss.
I just thought I felt something between us.
Are you falling for this guy?
Give me one more chance.
Stay.
Christmas in Homestead. On Hallmark Channel, the heart of Christmas.
Just a taste of Christmas in Homestead, written by Rick Garman. He is on the line with me now. Hello, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here. And I have thoroughly enjoyed much of your feel-good work over the years. So I am definitely in the camp of maybe guilty pleasure, but it's you bring people a lot of joy.
You know, I was just having this conversation yesterday with one of the producers of the movie that was just on this weekend. And, you know, 3.4 million people, I think it was something like that, watch the movie, and you know, hopefully at least 2 million enjoyed it. So you know, how many people get to say things like, you know, millions of people got a little bit of pleasure out of watching something you did. So
yeah, I think that's pretty powerful. So you started out wanting to be in the theater. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got started as a storyteller?
Well, I did a lot of theater in high school at Marion, and I wanted to be an actor. So when I was 18, I moved to Los Angeles and I went to an acting school, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And that was what I wanted my career to be. Then I graduated from that institution and went on an audition, and it was horrible and depressing. And I realized I just don't have the stomach for this. So literally one audition and I said, nope, not doing this anymore. But I still loved the theater and I loved being a part of those kinds of stories. So I turned to writing and stumbled into it and had a few plays that were produced back in the 90s at small theaters around the country, including one of them was done at Theater Cedar Rapids. And from there, my career just sort of went in weird places. I thought I would be a, you know, huge successful playwright after those plays were done, but that didn't happen.
And the list of huge successful playwrights is pretty short.
Is pretty short, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No matter how good you are.
Yeah, hard to make a living as a playwright. So I had day jobs. I did everything in the entertainment industry. I worked in the internet industry, but I kept writing. And in the 2000s, I had a TV show that went out that almost got made it by NBC. Then that didn't happen. And then in the 2010s, somewhere around 2015, a friend of a friend helped me stumble into this wonderful, weird world of writing TV movies. And I wrote a movie for a channel called Pixel that was called Late Bloomer. And they loved it and had me write several more. And then that got the attention of Hallmark. And it's been that ever since. And then in 2017, I was able to quit my day job and be a writer full time. So it took me a long time to be a success as a writer, but I managed to make it.
In turning your attention, a lot of your movies have been holiday movies. Was that something that was important to you before you started writing these movies? I mean, what was your relationship with the holiday season?
You know, I'm going to admit I didn't really have a relationship with the holiday season. My Christmas tradition was I would spend all day long at the movies. I would see four or five movies, and that was my Christmas. And I loved it because, again, storytelling and movies, and I enjoy all that. But I didn't have family in Los Angeles, and all of my friends were off with their families. So this was a great thing for me to do. So I didn't have a huge connection to Christmas, but Christmas is very important to the world of TV movies. And so I dove in. They asked me to write a Christmas movie, and I said, sure, I can do that. Why not?
And the very first one that you wrote was Christmas in Homestead, right?
Correct. That's the first Christmas movie, and it was my first movie for Hallmark.
All right. And it takes place in Iowa.
Correct. Yeah.
And there is a Homestead, Iowa, but you didn't actually know that when you started writing it, right?
I didn't. I thought Homestead worked as the name of a good town. You know, just because of it's a lot about the sort of, which a lot of the Hallmark movies are about, but you know, the small town family community coming together kind of thing. And Homestead just sounded like a good name for a town.
The movies that you're going to be screening when you're back in Iowa, you're going to be screening that one that I just mentioned, Christmas in Homestead. And you're also going to be screening A Shoe Addict's Christmas. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Why did you choose that one?
You know, choosing my favorite movies of the ones that have been made is a little bit of a, you know, it's like trying to choose your favorite child. But if you had to pin me down and say, what's your favorite, it would probably be A Shoe Addict's Christmas. It's fun and funny and a little bit different than a lot of the more traditional Hallmark movies. And it's got a great cast with Candace Cameron Bure and Luke McFarlane and the incredible Jean Smart, who is just a joy to watch and to meet and all that good stuff. And so it's a fun movie that I know a lot of people enjoy, and it's one of my favorites.
Well, I think that's, of course, one of the things that people really love about these Hallmark holiday movies is that they attract really high caliber talent, actors who we know and love. And Jean Smart is just incredible.
Goddess.
Exactly. In everything that she's done. What is that must be kind of a unique experience when you're writing these films. Do you imagine who might be playing your characters? Because there's sort of a revolving cast of Hallmark films.
Yeah. Sometimes when I write a movie, there's somebody attached. So I knew that Candace was going to be doing that role. But I didn't know who was going to be Charlie or Jake, the male lead. And no, I don't usually envision anybody specific, but them and always pleasantly surprised when I find out who they managed to get for these things.
Your most recent Hallmark film, I believe, is it Enchanted Christmas?
Most recent? No, that was several years ago.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No. Don't worry about it. There have been a lot of them.
Right, and everything lives in the same period of time online.
Right.
So I was going to ask you about that one, though, specifically, because that features Latinx actors. And one of the problems that people have pointed out many times over the years with Hallmark movies is that the cast doesn't reflect America. We see a real lack of diversity in these films. Has there been an effort made to change that?
I can't speak for Hallmark. I don't work directly for Hallmark, but I do a lot of movies for them. And the simple answer is yes, absolutely. That criticism has been heard and is not only actively being addressed. I'm pitching and working on a bunch of new potential projects. And one of the first things that they're talking about is diversity and making sure that we have casts that are representative of the people who are watching and the country in general. So yes, it's a huge focus, especially moving forward. There's been some big changes at Hallmark with their executive management and the way that they're structured, and they're really looking to tell some find different storytelling avenues and to sort of broaden the scope of what you see see on TV.
This is obviously not what you imagined yourself doing back when you were pursuing becoming a playwright and through many other iterations. When you started writing these television movies and started having success with them, were you conflicted about taking this path?
No, not at all. We know that these movies are not, they're not the award-winning things that get a lot of attention, and a lot of people don't think they're cool and stuff like that. But again, they have such a huge reach, and I've reached more people through these movies than I will probably ever reach in the other writing that I do. I have a lot of other projects that are sort of in the works that are all very different from Hallmark movies, but they give people joy, and that gives me joy. I'm proud of that. So if all I ever do is write Hallmark movies for the rest of my life, I think that is there are worse lives and worse careers to have.
Well, and I think particularly, I know that people have been loving these movies for many years, but particularly for the last two holiday seasons, I will tell you that I have indulged much, much more. This feels like a necessary medicine during the pandemic.
Well, I say it all the time and said it in a recent interview for the Gazette, but in a world gone mad, you need comfort,
all living in, right?
Which we're all living in. You know, regardless of you know, where you are in the political spectrum or where you're at in your life, there's no way you cannot look out the window and go, "Wow, things are crazy out there." And with this, you get a couple of hours of comfort food, and I think that that's needed, especially these days.
You left Iowa to go to LA pretty much as soon as you could.
As soon as I could, yes.
All right. And now you have left Los Angeles. You're living in Savannah, Georgia. What took you there?
Well, I one of the novel that I mentioned, the novel series that I mentioned, Interitas, when I started to write that story, I needed a place to set it. And for some reason, Savannah popped into my head. I'd literally been here once, one day, and was charmed by the city. But I wrote the novel and did a bunch of research and came here for many weeks, and I just sort of fell in love. It's a cool, interesting, different city, and I made some friends here and started coming here a lot. And then I bought a place a few years ago and was splitting time between LA and here. And then last year, you know, COVID, it got scary in LA, and I had a very good friend who passed away from it. He was 34 years old, completely healthy, no underlying conditions. And it's, I'm not going to lie, it scared the bejesus out of me. And so I came to Savannah to sort of hide out. It was not quite as crazy here. And I looked around and I'm like, why do I want to go back? I was kind of done with LA. I'd been there for 35 years. And so now so a year ago, I made the full-time move. I called friends and I said, get rid of all my stuff. I'm not coming back.
Wow. You, as a writer, you spend a lot of time working on your own anyway. And it sounds like you are incredibly prolific. Can you give me a little bit of a window into what a workday is like and how you're able to produce so much?
Another thing that I say often, and this is going to sound a little pitiful at first, but I don't have a life. And by that, I mean, I don't have a spouse. I don't have children. I don't have pets. I don't even have plants. I have a hard enough time keeping myself alive. So I don't have the kind of responsibilities that a lot of other people have that take up their time. If you have a family, you have to pay attention to them. I don't have that. And that's by choice, and I'm happy with that. But that means that I have a lot more time that I can do the things that I want to do. So my typical day when I have projects, active projects, is I'll set an alarm and I get up and I treat it like a job. I write in the morning. I have a lunch break. I write in the afternoon. I have dinner. And usually during the day, I'll work on the things that I'm getting paid for. Let's put it that way. Again, it's a job. And then at night, I will often write the things that I'm passionate about. I'll be working on the novels. I'll be working on other scripts that, or TV shows or movies that I'm hoping can get produced in other places.
You will be doing a writer's workshop when you're in Iowa for adults, but also for teenagers. You were in Iowa dreaming of having a career in entertainment, in the theater. What do you want to talk with teenagers about when you're here?
I think a lot of it is going to be about not giving up. You know, again, I had some success in my 20s. I had some almost success in my 30s, but it took me till 50. I was 50 years old when I quit my job and became a writer full time. So by the time that I became successful at it, I have this catalog of work that I can now use and say, hey, I had that idea 20 years ago. I can turn that into wrote three pages of and then never finished. I can turn that into a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Rick, thank you so much for talking with me. Safe travels and happy holidays.
Thank you very much.
Rick Garman is a writer who has written more than 20 movies for the Hallmark Channel, many of them holiday movies. He grew up in Marion, Iowa, and is coming back to his hometown to share his work and help raise money for Marion's community holiday lights. You can find more information at marion.shopwhereilive.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
I'm Charity Nebbe.